In 1948, Boston-born Irish accordion player Joe Durain made the first of a series of recordings that later became part of the canon of traditional Irish music.
It's only actually really in recent years that I became aware that those recordings became the, what do they call them, the stuff of legend. And I was very surprised by that.
After 12 years of being at the center of the thriving Dudley Street music scene, Joe was forced to leave his first instrument behind.
So ultimately, I wound up selling my button box to help raise money for the piano accordion. Now, back then, they were very upset with me. I said, hey, I have a living here, and I have a family to provide for.
On April 23rd, Joe Durain opened the prestigious American Folklife Center's concert series, Homegrown 2003, The Music of America, on the steps of the Library of Congress. I'm Maggie Holtzberg, folklorist for the Massachusetts Cultural Council, and this is Joe Durain's story. The story of the greatest comeback in the history of Irish music. I had the opportunity to sit down with Joe Durain recently in his home in Randolph, Massachusetts.
Very early on, there were Irish radio programs even back then, one of which was the famous Boy from Ireland, Terry O'Toole, who was an Irish tenor type of thing. And he had a live radio program almost every Sunday. But on that same program, there was regularly, this is a wonderful accordion player, this Jerry O'Brien. And my mom said from the time I was like 4 or 5, when they turned on the radio, that was fine, they'd be listening on a Sunday. But as soon as the accordion started to play, I would come running from wherever I was in the house, and she said, you just, in front of the radio, staring at it, and you're just jumping and bouncing around, and they thought that was hilarious. But as soon as the accordion stopped playing, that was it. I left. And it got to the point where I said I wanted to play that. I wanted to play like that man and one thing. And this went on and on and on. And, of course, at first they figured, well, you know, he's 5 years old, this type, this will pass. But it didn't. And by the time I was 10, I guess I had driven my parents near bonkers. And so they finally shopped around. Of course, money was a very tight thing back in those days. So this would put it at about 1935 when they became aware of this. And by the time I was 10, which would be 1940 or so, they had contacted Jerry through the radio station, and Jerry agreed to come out and give me some lessons, private lessons. I knew about the music clubs. That's what they used to call them. They were, in fact, sessions is what they were. Now, there was the Roxbury Music Club, and there was the Dorchester Music Club. And it was always held on a Sunday. The music clubs were so interesting in those days because they were all immigrants that played there. There weren't too many Irish Americans there. You could probably number them on the fingers of one hand. These are the guys who had the music.
Yeah.
It's that simple. These are the guys that had the music. But what was happening was you'd have a musician from Galway, you'd have one from Sligo, you'd have two from Cork, or you'd have one from Kerry, that type of thing. You might have a Donegal player or something. And you'd hear these guys playing the same tunes, but they're all a little bit different. So out of that, I think you got what I heard very early on. Oh, I can tell you're from Boston, a Boston style. And I think that's maybe where that arose from, that kind of mixture.
You are listening to the Joe Durain story, and I'm Maggie Holtzberg. In 1947, Joe entered the Roxbury ballroom scene and was also featured on live radio in Boston, where he sparked the interest of a local recording company.
The idea was I went in to do one record, two sides. Mm-hmm. That's what it's about, and I figured, well, gee, this is great. And but that developed, there was more demand after a while, and then more and more. So I did a total of 8 over about a 4 or 5 year. So that'd be 16 sides. They went all over the world. They went to England, they went to Australia. They went to Europe. They went all over the United States because Byron DeWitt was set up as a catalog thing. And he had catalogs which he would mail out. And people could then call from California or write in from Ireland or wherever. And he had a real jump on all this very large catalog distribution for its time. I had no inkling for many years. It's only actually really in recent years that I became aware that those recordings became the, what did they call them, the stuff of legend. And I was very surprised by that. I was delighted. There were five ballrooms on Dudley Street. Five. I don't think a lot of people realize it, but in my mind, what made the whole thing work was Dudley Street Terminal, the MBTA. Because you came out of the Dudley Street Terminal, and directly across the street was the Dudley Street Opera House. And then, maybe 60 yards down, on the same side, was Winslow Hall. Now you look kitty corner across the street, you're in the square now, on the old Rose Croy building, which is still there. On the top floor of that was a ballroom. And that's where all the Canadians and the Scots used to go, like the Cape Breton people and Scots and French Canadians, and they'd all go up there. They had some wonderful music up there, some great bands that had come down from Cape Breton and one thing and another. Now, about 60 yards or so below that, still on Dudley Street, was Hibernian. And on the top floor, that place could accommodate upwards of maybe 900 to 1,000. And another 60 or 75 yards below, that was probably the biggest of them all in the Colonial. And a standard thing was about 1,200 people every Saturday night. And so you came out of Dudley Street Station, and you could stand anywhere on Dudley Street. And, of course, there was no air conditioning. There was nothing in those times. And in the warm weather, all the windows would be open, and you were drowning in music. And, of course, then after a while, that whole scene collapsed, the whole Dudley Street scene. Everything collapsed. That was the major part of my income. So when that whole scene collapsed, all of a sudden, I'm married now.
Yeah.
So I'm saying, well, what am I going to do? Now, there were very few places left to play, except for a few bars. Mm-hmm. Now, the bars were bars as opposed to what we now think of as pubs. These were sawdust on the floor type of thing. You know, I'll prop him up in the corner. He'll be all right when he wakes up, you know. I said, no, no, I don't want to do this. I realized that the only place for me to go if I was going to continue to play, and I have to play, I had to play, I have to go to piano recording and go into the pop field. There was a 35-year gap when I did not have a button box, nor did I play one, nor did I play any real traditional Irish music. You know, outside of maybe at St. Patrick's Day, you'd be somewhere, or you could be at a wedding, and somebody said, do you guys know the Irish washerwoman? But everybody, even all the Jewish guys, knew that. Essentially, yeah, I didn't play any Irish music for all that time. I really didn't. I was so busy doing this. I was doing 5 gigs a week, you know, on average. So, and I still remembered how to play a few jigs or something. But, just a couple of simple jigs, maybe something like that's fine. But if I had to sit down and play, really couldn't, no.
Wow.
I'd have to sit down in the woodshed. And then I'm saying to myself, but to what end? To what end? I mean, I had been left with the feeling that, you know, for me to go back to, Irish music on piano accordion. And then I said, no, I've been away from this now for too long. So what had happened was, this was around 1990. Then I get a call from Paddy Noonan early in 1993 or late 1992. I forget which. Saying he had bought all the rights to all the old 78s. And we think one of the first ones we're going to reissue is your Joe Dermain Irish Accordion. What happened then? Of course, all the record companies, they will send copies of any new releases to Earl Hitchner. So Earl Hitchner gets this thing. He listens to it, and he said, my God, this guy must have been great. At least this is what I understand from what he was telling me. way back when. And he figured these things were done, you know, maybe in the 20s or the 30s or some such thing as this. And, you know, when did he die? So he called up Paddy Noonan, and he's talking about this. He said, my God, he said, this is really great plan. He said, when did this guy die? Where did he live and whatever? Paddy says, he's not dead. He said, I just talked to him, you know, a month ago. He's living in Randolph, and this is his phone number. So Earl calls me. Now, I knew Earl Hitchner by name only because we've been subscribed to the Echo for years. So I knew the name. And we started talking. He said, where are you playing? I said, I'm not playing. I haven't played since 1990. Haven't played a note. Oh, but you still have your accordion. I said, my piano accordion. He said, no, the button accordion. I said, I haven't had a button accordion for 35 odd years or something. But you're going to do this again. I mean, you're going to play it. And I said, well, no, Earl, I don't. See. Now, this is 1993. At this point, I'm 63 years old. So Earl says, well, certainly you're going to come back and you're going to play. I said, Earl, I don't think I could ever play at that level again. I mean, those things were done, you know, 1947 through 50, 51. I mean, you know, you're talking a long time here. And I had never met this man, I had to talk to him before that. So he says, you know something? He says, every time we come back to Irish music in the button box, he says, your voice changes. And I said, my voice changes. I said, I don't understand. He says, yeah. He says, your voice just takes on a different change. It's like it's full of life. He says, I'm telling you, he said, there's a fire in your belly yet. He said, the fire's still burning there.
Shortly after acquiring a button accordion, Joe was invited to perform at the world-renowned Wolf Trap Festival.
And the response was just incredible. People all over the place, including me, everybody was crying. And my daughter was sobbing. I was crying. My wife was crying. Half the people, more than half of the people in that tent. We had about 1,200 in that tent. And they just raised the roof. It was just an incredible thing altogether. It was like coming home again or something. And then as I was getting off the stage, they had to bring me back, you know, like to take a bow. And I had to swear to all those people that I would never again quit playing. Without a doubt, other than the day I get married, maybe, or the dates that my two kids were born, is probably the single biggest day of my life. I was on cloud nine.
This has been the story of Joe Durain, one of the Commonwealth's cultural treasures. If you know of a cultural treasure in your community, let us know by calling 617-727-3668 or visit our website at www.massculturalcouncil.org. For WUMB, this is Maggie Holzberg, and this story has been produced with funding by the Massachusetts Cultural Council.
Commonwealth Journal is a weekly production of WUMB-FM Radio at the University of Massachusetts Boston. This special series was developed in cooperation with the Massachusetts Cultural Council. Funding has been provided by Blue Cross Blue Shield of Massachusetts. Our engineer is Dave Palmatier. Danielle Knight is our assistant producer. Lisa Hickler is our associate producer. And our executive producer is Patricia Monteith. I'm Barbara Neely. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at 617-287-6913 or on the web at wumb.org/Commonwealth Journal. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next week for Commonwealth Journal.